So most of you know me because I see a bunch of familiar faces. But my name is David Getoff. I'm a board-certified clinical nutritionist, a board-certified traditional naturopath. I'm licensed in a number of different states. California doesn't actually license those occupations. And I treat a lot of autism. And the biggest problems that I see with many different conditions, illnesses, diseases, whatever word you want to use, is that for the most part, the vast majority of the medical profession and the vast majority of the public do not realize how many of these conditions, and today we're going to be talking about autism, are treatable. And I don't mean are treatable like maybe you'll be lucky if you get a tiny result. I mean they're treatable and you can see some pretty major improvements. And you never know how much of an improvement you're going to get until you start working on it. But the idea that as far as medicine is concerned, autism is not treatable. And to give you an example of that before we start going into some real specifics, one of the older organizations that works with disseminating information both to the public and to the medical profession about both autism and treatments that are usable that work with autism is right here in San Diego. It's ARI, the Autism Research Institute. It was originally started by Bernard Rimland, PhD. He died recently, in the last year. Fabulous man. The institute goes on. And he always believed that there were ways that we could do things and ways that we could learn more, and we have to be able to do even better than we can do now. And there are, for those people that are willing to look, which for the most part is not the medical profession. And I don't even really want to blame the doctor. If the doctor goes through and spends $100,000 or $200,000 going through medical school, and that particular doctor, that particular man or woman, is taught, this, by the way, is an untreatable condition. There's nothing you can do about it, so there's no sense wasting your time. They have a reason to believe that. They've spent huge amounts of money to get this education, and the people up there that know everything, nobody knows everything, are telling them that this is an untreatable condition. So they simply parrot it back. And very, very rarely do you find the physician that says, is anything really untreatable? Don't we learn new things? I mean, I learned that in medical school, but things change all the time. Let's take a look and find out. Those are rare people. So the Autism Research Institute has a couple conferences a year, and their big statement is Defeat Autism Now, which was always called DAN until the Divers Action Network sued them last year and said, you can't use DAN, you can't use DAN, that's our registered trademark. So now they try to always make sure it says Defeat Autism Now, and they don't just use the acronym DAN, which is fine. You know, I mean, I understand if you've got a trademark on something. But I was going to those conferences year after year after year after year, and it was so nice to see lots, and they're still going on. Last one I went to was this year, to see lots of medical doctors. Now, percentage-wise, it's tiny. But, you know, you've got a room that's got maybe 50, 60, 80 medical doctors that are interested in learning how to treat autism. The only sad part is almost all of them are there because they have an autistic child. They're not open-minded people that, wow, I got to learn about this. This looks interesting. I'm going to investigate it. They got an autistic child and they said, geez, isn't there anything else I can do? And they happened to find the Autism Research Institute and started learning more to be able to find that out. So every year when they have their conference, they have always, all the ones I've been to, which is quite a number, ask for a show of hands of how many people this is the first DAN conference you've been to. And, you know, a bunch of us raise our hand. And then sometimes they say how many people have been to at least two, how many people have been to at least three. By the time they get to four, there are very few of us that still have our hands up. And then they say, okay, how many people are in the medical profession, and this is the first time you've been here? And a bunch of hands go up, and that always gets applause from everybody out there because most of the people are parents. And they're so happy to see that there are at least some more physicians that are interested in trying to see what they can do. And about a year ago, they had the, I believe it was the recently retired either president or vice president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So, you know, we're talking about a physician who was responsible for one of the biggest organizations for treating children. And she came in to listen to what was going on and to see whether or not maybe she could learn enough that she'd be able to get her association. And again, I'm not sure if it was active or if she was the past vice president, interested. And they had her talk for a couple minutes. She was very nice, and she was interested. She couldn't get them interested. They still say it's untreatable. After all the stuff that she saw and all the different cases of people's autism getting much better. So we really have a very, very large brick wall that we're trying to climb over. And the most important thing for anybody that is interested in this and listening to this and, you know, trying to get more information on, well, but if it is treatable, I want to know how, is stop wasting your time either being angry at your own physician who says it's untreatable, stop trying to do something, you know, this is the way it's going to be, period, and instead see if you can find somebody in your area that's already on one of the Dan referral lists, I've been on there for years, or that's open-minded enough to be able to learn some of this, because some of the doctors that were there, the reason they went to the autism conference is because most of them have an autistic child, but because somebody said, I want you to go to this. And the only reason they went is because the other person's child that told them to go, they saw this child improving with a condition that's not supposed to improve. And they said, it's amazing. And the parents said, no, it's not amazing. I'm doing all the things that have been shown to help treat autism. Well, but there isn't anything. Yes, doctor, there is. You just don't know about it. You could learn a lot about it if you go to the Autism Research Institute conference, find them online, and go to one of their conferences. So some people went, small number, because they had seen some patient in their practice dramatically improving, going uphill after they were taught you can't. And they asked the parent, are you doing something different? I mean, you don't improve from autism, and your son is improving. I say son because part of autism has to do with a link with hormones. And testosterone makes you more likely to become autistic, and estrogen is somewhat protective. So there are very few percentage-wise of girls that are autistic. It's mostly guys. And so I usually say son because it's most likely. But there is a lot that can be done. So what are some of the reasons, and what do we see going on right now with autism? First of all, there is absolutely no question. There used to be. But the question has been answered as to, are there a larger percentage of people becoming autistic today than there were, let's say, 75 years ago? I mean, pick however long ago you want to say, 50 years ago, 75 years ago. I'm 57, so you could see, easily say 50 years ago because of some of the certain changes. And a lot of times, even government agencies had been saying, up until the research pretty much showed it, but sometimes they haven't looked at the research, that it's not that there are more autistic children now. It's that we diagnose it better. It's that we look at it better, so we investigate it better. So a huge study was done. I believe the biggest one was done by the Mind Institute. And they looked at everything that could be looked at, having to do with how it was diagnosed before, how it's diagnosed now. Is it possible that there's more diagnostic criteria, different diagnostic criteria, more people looking at it before? And it was completely squashed. It's absolutely not. There's no contest whatsoever. We went from somewhere between 1 in 5 and 10,000. So one child in 5 to 10,000 being autistic. Currently, the statistics, depending on the state and the particular research study you look at, is that one in anywhere between a low of about 110 or a high of about 150 ends up becoming autistic. That's a rather large increase. I mean, that's almost an epidemic. When you go from, let's say, 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 150, that's a huge, gigantic increase in one particular problem. So they started looking to see, well, what things have changed. And, of course, again, we have politics. We're always going to have politics. I don't think we can ever have a country without politics. I guess there's good and bad politics. And I always tell people, I'm not a Republican or a demagogue. I'm a realist. I want whoever is going to help the public, and I don't care what you label them. I will never vote party lines. I vote whoever I think is going to do the best and maybe isn't going to have themselves become a marionette and be controlled by everybody. But it's very, very non-politically correct and assaultive to a multi-billion dollar industry, otherwise known as the pharmaceutical industry, to in any way insinuate that vaccinations have anything to do with autism, because they make billions of dollars giving everybody vaccines, and they've actually managed, with almost no safety research and almost no efficacious research, to make it mandatory in most states that your children have to have a whole bunch of vaccines before they can get into school. And in the states that have an arbitrary exemption where all you have to do is say, you know, not religious, my kid doesn't have a medical exemption, I just don't think it's a good idea. I'm not sure I want my child not to be vaccinated. If you happen to be in one of those states, of which there are a less number, and California is one of them, they won't tell you that that's true, because that might have a lot of people not giving vaccines. So if you go into schools, private or public, makes no difference. They're both sworn by the same law. They both have to abide by the same law. If you say, do I really have to give my kid these vaccinations? Because maybe you've just moved to a different district, or you've moved into this city, or you've come into the state. The intake personnel, whether it's just a clerk, whether it's the intake nurse, will say, yeah, of course, that's the law. I mean, your child can't enroll in this fill-in-the-blank, nursery school, elementary school, you know, daycare, high school, unless they've had all of their vaccines. It's a requirement. Now, it's not a requirement. They're lying. But they will tell you that in California. In some states, it is a requirement, but in California, it's not. And the only way you will be able to even not do that is if you know before you go in that it's not a requirement. So you have to say, I'll take the waiver, which they immediately have to give you. And you could write it on a piece of toilet paper if you wanted to. I mean, it's not an official legal waiver that has to be notarized or witnessed. It's just a piece of paper that says, I don't think it's in the best interest of my child. My child is a minor. I am the controlling parent, and I don't want that. And it gets signed, and that's it. They will never ask you again to have your kids vaccinated. But they will never tell you that. And they worded the law in such a way as to make it legal for them to lie to you at the beginning. Because the law says you have to have all these vaccinations or you can't enter all of these schools. In my 9-week class, I actually show the law up on the bulletin board. And then a couple paragraphs later, it says, no, what we just said up there isn't true. You don't have to have any of these. All you have to do is sign a waiver. They worded it that way so they can say the law says you have to, because it does. Except that a couple paragraphs later, it says, no, it doesn't. You don't have to. So, sort of they're lying, but they're not lying. I mean, when you say, really and truly, I have to, there's no way out, and for them to say, yes, that's correct, there's no way out, that is a lie, because, of course, all you need is a waiver. But they have been told, and I've had many teachers in my classes, and I've had them ask the administration, and so I know I'm not making this up, you will be fired if you let people know there's a waiver. You are required to tell people that you have to. They have to know about the waiver. I think that's about as unethical as you can possibly get. So what happened with vaccines is that if you go back 50 years, the number of vaccinations and therefore the amount of all of these things that are in the vaccines, we're going to go over a little bit of what's in there, was way lower than it has become. There was no measles vaccine. There was no flu vaccine. I mean, basically, you got a DPT, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, and polio. That's about it. All these other things we've got now, hemophilus influenza, hepatitis B, and a couple of others, they didn't exist. And you didn't need a tetanus shot to get to school. That was only if you hurt yourself on a rusty nail, and now they give tetanus shots to people for all sorts of things, and there's no good research on tetanus shots either. And so we have a whole bunch of books here that I'll go over a little bit on some of them that go over some of the facts having to do with vaccinations. But one of the major things that has happened is the number of vaccinations that a child gets has skyrocketed. So there's no question in the mind of anybody who is truly open-minded and really wants to know the answer and has investigated this thoroughly that no matter how many different possibilities there may be, as far as what some of the causes of autism are, absolutely vaccines are one of them. And if you were to ask 1,000 parents whose children were born normal and became autistic, when did that happen? The vast majority of them will tell you it happened between one day and a month and a half after either a DPT shot or an MMR shot, and totally normally developing child. All the various different tests, all normal, good eye contact, good verbal skills, good growth, speed of growth, everything was perfect, and all of a sudden they get one of these shots, And the next day, or a week later, or 2 weeks later, they're screaming and yelling and bouncing off the walls. They can't make eye contact. They can't concentrate on anything. Sometimes they're screaming for hours at a time. And the mother or father, who spends a lot of time with the child and knows, that's not my child. I've never seen this before. I've seen this child since the child was born. This is new. This had to be caused by something different. Something is going on. What happened? Well, he just got an MMR shot or a DPT shot. And they call the doctor up. And the doctor, because the doctor was lied to, and believes this in most cases, says, no, it wasn't the shot. That's not possible. Oh, and there's even a research study that showed it wasn't the shot, because they managed to fund one purposely looking in the wrong direction. And some of the investigators that looked at the Institute of Medicine's large research study that was done theoretically to determine whether vaccinations were linked to autism, but was really done to prove they weren't. And that's not research. Research is done to look, not to prove. Some of these investigators looked at the way it was done and said this research done was done so poorly that it never should have been accepted for publication. But the doctor looks at it and says, oh, nope, research says no problem, that wasn't it. So, you know, I have a hard time because I don't want to say that doctors have no part of this and that they're just being snowed by everybody, because there have been research studies that have been published and done where they've looked to see what percentage, and let's pick the flu shot, what percentage of physicians get the flu shot every year. And it's about 45 to 50%. They've got it right there in their office, okay? They're giving it to everybody. And half of them won't get it because they know how often it causes problems and they don't want to take that chance. But if you go into pediatricians and obstetricians, they said about 83% wouldn't get it. It goes way up because they say even more problems. So there are a lot of physicians out there that do have some amount of belief system that these may be a problem, and they don't say a word and they give the shots all day, because that's what they're supposed to do, and they want to hold their license, and they don't want the medical boards to say, you know, you're saying something that doesn't have any good backup behind it. And so we do have a problem, and the problem has to do with politics, and it's really hard to get around that. But as far as do we have any fairly good proof that something in the vaccines, and we'll talk about a couple of different things in there, absolutely is at least part of this huge escalation in autism. And we do. We do, because one of the best ways to do research is if you are able to observe populations where some change makes a huge difference in what you're observing. So, for example, since we now have somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 in 150 children becoming autistic, if it were true that the vaccine or vaccines were at least some major part of this, maybe not the only one, there are a couple possibilities in addition to the vaccine, but that the vaccine was a big part of this, we should be able to find some group of people who on religious beliefs or philosophical beliefs don't believe in vaccines, and take a large group of them and see how many are autistic. Well, that has been done, but it has been withheld from the public. And there was a clinic back east where they are treating only Amish. Amish do not believe in vaccinations. They don't believe in automobiles. You know, they'll spit on your car as they go by in their horse and buggy, which I'm not saying anything wrong with, but I mean, they don't believe in that. They had a population in this clinic of 30,000 children. Three cases of autism, and those three children had been vaccinated. It's not possible to have 30,000 children with no autism at the rates we have today, except for the three that were vaccinated, so we pull them out, if vaccines have nothing to do with autism. It's impossible. So they conveniently withhold that from the public. And there have been a number of different people that treat specific communities, such as the Amish, that have said, we never see autism. Never. And if we ever do, for some reason, somebody got convinced to get a vaccine. So there is enough observational evidence that we know there's a link there. Now, one of the things that has been looked at over and over again is a particular type of mercury that has been used for dozens and dozens of years, many, many decades, to help preserve and the manufacture of the vaccines, and that type of mercury is called thimerosal. Thimerosal has been shown by some of the expert scientists that work with thimerosal doing research, such as Professor Boyd Haley and a number of others, to be one of the most toxic forms of mercury that they can look at. Everything, every time they put a teeny tiny amount, way less than a child gets in a vaccine, in with a bunch of nerve cells, they start killing the nerve cells. So it's not at all surprising that that would be one of the things in there. What's happening now is slowly but surely, I don't know why, probably because of maybe a little bit of protectionism, just to make sure you can't point your finger at them or whatever, they've been pulling the mercury out, not all of it, and not all the vaccines, but they've been pulling out of a bunch, and the autism rate has not gone down. So therefore, they're saying, you see, we told you it wasn't the thimerosal. We're pulling the thimerosal out, and the autism rate's the same. But the phenol is still in there. The formaldehyde is still in there. They've loaded a whole bunch of mercury and some other preservatives in there. So as far as the people that really are looking at this are concerned, all they've proven is that they can manage to find something just as bad as that to replace it with. And so that doesn't mean it wasn't causing it. It just means getting rid of it and making the changes you guys have made. I don't mean you guys. I mean the pharmaceutical companies. Hasn't altered anything. There are a lot of poisons that destroy the neurological system. Mercury is only one of them. We've got pesticides, we've got herbicides. Probably one of the most interesting tests that was done a number of years ago is somebody said, well, most children are born with some amount of hair. Not all. Some are born bald, but most are born with some amount of hair. And hair is one of the parts that we can look at for heavy metals. Generally, people that understand heavy metals and how they get sequestered around the body look at either urine, stool, or hair to see what's going on with heavy metals. You can't look at blood because blood has been shown not to allow the heavy metals to stay there very long. So if a doctor says, fine, you think there's heavy metals in your body, I'll go ahead and run a blood test. Don't even let them do it. They're wasting their money. Because any amount of heavy metals in your blood that were in there maybe 6 months ago because of a vaccination or something, or of course could be a mercury filling, we'll go over a little bit about that, it's gone. Because the body doesn't want it there. It sequesters it out. It pushes it out. It's in your liver. It's in your kidneys. It's in your brain. It's in some other part of your body where it will be doing damage for the rest of your life, but it's no longer in the blood. It gets it out of the blood very quickly. So a blood test for heavy metals is a very, very poor test, and all the experts have shown that, but the doctors aren't being taught it. So they will often run one of those tests because somebody says, I want you to run a test. I'm sure my kid has got mercury poisoning, and they run a blood test. So, you know, you look in the wrong place, you don't find anything, and you say there isn't a problem, and that's not the way to do it. If you wanted to, well, first let me finish up on the study I was talking about. So they did this study on birth hair, and what they did was they took a sample of the birth hair of a very large number of births during a period of time, and then they followed those children to see which ones would become autistic. And was there any correlation between the amount of mercury found in the hair and the children that became autistic? And what they published, which is a very good, ignorant, stupid study, is they published that, well, obviously, there is no correlation between mercury and autism because the children with the highest mercury in their hair were the least likely to become autistic over the next years. Well, all of the specialists in heavy metal toxicity, which I go to conferences and learn from all the time, looked at that study and said, oh my God, that's a perfect study. That's exactly what I would have told you would have happened. Those fetuses that were working fairly decently and were able to push the mercury out and get it into the hair had little enough left in their neurological system that they were the least likely to become autistic. And the ones whose bodies were not able to get it out into the hair were much more likely to become autistic because it was sitting inside the brain and the body. So it actually did, the results were exactly what the autism experts that understand what's going on would have expected. But the doctors and the researchers that don't know what's happening looked at it backwards and said, you see, there's no connection. Look, high mercury, low autism risk. So they got everything backwards. So we get a lot of things that get thrown at us totally backwards. So we've got pesticides, we've got herbicides. One of the things about mercury is that mercury has been proven to be transplacental. That means if there's mercury in the woman's blood, there's nothing that prevents it from getting into the placenta and into the body. And so if a mother has some dental work done while she's pregnant, you're going to have a much higher level of mercury going into the placenta because you're drilling out the mercury. Unless, of course, this is not a silver filling, which would be great, but most often it's a silver filling, and silver fillings are 52% mercury. They've been outlawed in, I believe, 3 countries. In the United States, we're still putting them in all day long. They should be outlawed here, but they're not. If somebody just has a bunch of silver fillings, anything you do, biting, chewing, drinking hot soup, anything like that, it just stimulates the amount of mercury coming out, and it will go into the placenta and it will go into the fetus. So you can have a child that is born with autism or gets autism soon after, and they'll say, you see, it's not the mercury, it's not the vaccine, this person chose not to get a vaccine, and they're still autistic. Well, yeah, but of course, if the mercury from their silver fillings is what destroyed the neurological system, it's just a different route of mercury coming in. So we have a big problem. And if you look into vaccines, which is worthwhile, which is why we brought a bunch of books on vaccines here, this one is by Dr. Tim O'Shea. It's one of my favorites, even though he doesn't specifically talk about autism. It's called The Sanctity of Human Blood. Vaccination is not immunization. Because one of the most infuriating things is the way we market. So if I say a word that is not true, often enough, people start thinking it that way. So if somebody continues to say, did you get your immunizations? Then we start to think of them as immunizations. Well, but they're not immunizations, they're vaccinations. It's only by doing major testing on that person's immune system years later you get to find out if they did any immunizing at all. But they are vaccinations. So they should be called vaccinations. But if we call them immunizations, it sells them. It makes people, I want to go get immunized. Well, you have no idea if you're going to get immunized. As a matter of fact, the research shows you're more likely not to get immunized, because if you take a look at the times that the CDC took like a 10-year period and said, okay, let's see of all of the children that got measles in this particular 10-year period, how many of them had been properly vaccinated? 65% in one of the studies. 65% properly vaccinated, and those are the ones that got measles. Well, if that doesn't show that the vaccination at least often doesn't work, I don't know what does. Sherry Tenpenny, who has probably done more research on vaccines and vaccine side effects than the vast majority of physicians out there, because she is a physician. There's a couple people that run the National Vaccine Information Center. Fabulous organization. I believe it's NVIC, I think it's .org, National Vaccine Information Center. The two women who started that because of vaccine-damaged children probably know more than anybody on the planet, but they're not physicians. When it comes to physicians knowing that much, Dr. Tenpenny is one of the top. And she came out with a book fairly recently called Saying No to Vaccines, a Source Guide for All Ages. She also has a couple of videos. Her videos are great. One is called Vaccines, the Risks, the Benefits, the Choices. The other was called Vaccines, What the CDC and Science Reveals. Because she spent thousands of hours, and what she did, which is fabulous, is she uses, and in the book, in the slides in the book to also, she uses the government research to make her point. So she doesn't make stuff up and say, this looks like this and that looks like that. She's using research from the National Institutes of Health, from the Centers for Disease Control, from one of the biggest periodicals that's used for death by the United States, which is called Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Review. So she's using, basically the best way to put it would be, she's using their own documentation to bury them, to show that what they're telling us about vaccines are not a problem is not what their research has shown. So there's quite a bit about that. The easiest book to read, not my favorite, but the easiest, is called Vaccines, Are They Really Safe and Effective? By Neil Miller. The reason it is not my favorite, and I hope he's changed this in the current edition, but I haven't checked it, is that I have a person in my family who was a science teacher at the Bronx High School of Science in New York for many, many years. Very, very educated person, very interested in science. And when I had an argument with him, because he didn't realize how vaccines haven't been researched. And so I sent him a copy of that to look at. And he looked at a couple of statements that Neil Miller had written in there about this research study said this and that one said that. Went to the back of the book, and he pulled where the actual reference was to those, I think it was three different studies. And he went to the biomedical library, and those studies didn't exist. Now, that doesn't mean the studies didn't really exist. That just means that as somebody was translating things from one place to another place, he got a journal wrong, he got a page wrong, he got an issue wrong, he couldn't find them. And that's very bad, because you got to remember, medical profession and scientific people that are on one side will always love to throw darts at us on the other side saying, oh, you don't have research. So the worst thing you can have is the research is not properly documented. If you're looking at Tim O'Shea's book, everything he says is right where he says it is. If you're looking at Sherry Tenpenny's book, everything she says is right where she says it is. Neil Miller has legitimate information in there. I have nothing against him. He's helped educate a lot of people. But somebody didn't do their work properly checking all the references to make sure that it was all written correctly, and that starts to cause a problem if you're using that to document something. So it's a very good book. It's got some good charts in it, and the information is valid, but you got to be careful if somebody looks up those references. Some of them aren't where they say they are. As far as other causes of autism, they're numerous. We just don't know. We keep on learning new things. In the last, oh, let's say 5 to 10 years, this being 2009, but everything I'm saying is going to be valid, you know, 20 years from now. The researchers at the Vitamin D Research Council are finding that there's a much higher rate of autism during the winter months, or in children that were being born when the mother was gestating during mostly the winter months, meaning that her vitamin D levels were likely lower because vitamin D is produced in our body by sun and there wasn't enough. So that's not a main, like, wow, okay, no, really, thimerosal doesn't cause it. You know, vitamin D causes it. And some of these people will say that. Everybody likes to grab a thing to get you to read their article. But vitamin D may be one of the other things that we have to take a look at. So that's certainly a possibility. And most people's vitamin D levels have been shown to be way too low. There's a specific test called the 25-hydroxy. Hydroxy is capital O, capital H. So it gets written 25-OH vitamin D. It's, when you say it, it's 25-hydroxy vitamin D. That particular test, as of now, because it keeps changing, the Vitamin D Research Council is telling us that when it's done in the U.S., with U.S., what would be the way to put it? Because if you do it in, I think, Canada and the U.K., their units are different. So when we say that the 25-hydroxyvitamin D test in the U.S., that they're claiming a healthy level that people should have is probably between about 55 and 80, somewhere in there. That's nanograms per deciliter of blood. And if you go to some other country, the number's different because they're using a different set of references. So you have to make sure you're taking a look to see. But if you look at the lab test that comes in from, let's say, LabCorp or Quest, it says that the reference range, which is what the doctor looks at, depending on which one comes in, is currently about 32 to 100. And the Vitamin D Research Council has shown that you really need to be upwards of 50. But unless the doctor has read the research or listened to the council presentations, he or she looks at the study that comes in from the lab and says, oh, well, your vitamin D is 38. Yeah, 32 to 100, you're fine. Because the lab is still using old-fashioned reference ranges. So I always tell my patients, if somebody's coming in, bring me your lab results. I don't want to know what the doctor says about them, because the doctor doesn't know clinical nutrition. That's my job. The doctor knows drugs. So bring me your lab results. And sometimes the doctor will just call them up and say, everything looks great, and they'll come in and say, everything was great. And I go, look at your notes. I said, bring me your lab results. I don't want everything looks great. So they have the doctor fax me the lab results, and there are five or six things that are in the wrong places. But the doctor doesn't know how to recognize them, because that's not what they were taught. Vitamin D is a good example. Their vitamin D is 38. I want it to be 50 to 80. And the doctor saw it was in the range. So they just said it was fine. It's not fine. So vitamin D is yet one more thing we want to take a look at. MMR and DPT, there are so many different people whose children became autistic after one of those shots that we know something in there is going on. Might it be the actual vaccine? Might it be the measles or mumps or rubella or diphtheria part of the vaccine and not the adjuvants that are put in there or the preservatives? Sure. But nobody's doing the test. They don't want to do those tests. They don't want to find out. It's much easier to point to the improperly done test that says that there's no correlation because that gets them off the hook. So we have a big, big, big problem. And just so you'll know, because if a doctor ever tells you, of course stuff has been safety tested, of course it's been tested for efficacy to show that it does what it's supposed to do, have them bring you the tests. They don't like that. Really? Wow. So it really is based on science. Could I see those tests? I won't know how to understand it, but I have somebody that does. I'd like to see them. Then they get mad at you because now you're questioning them. No, you're not questioning them. You're questioning the test. I want to see the test. So what happens now is when they do a vaccine test, this has been going on for years and years, they never test the vaccine against an unvaccinated population. They test the vaccine against the current vaccine. So they come out with a new flu vaccine, and they test to see whether people get more side effects than people getting the other flu vaccine. And if they're getting the same number of side effects, well, it must be fine, because that was fine. Wait a minute, hold it, stop the presses, that's a little ridiculous. And then if you take a look at the very few initial studies that were ever done on vaccines, they claimed to do a placebo control. For those of you that don't know exactly what a placebo by definition would be a substance that has no effect. Anything that has an effect cannot be a placebo, because the whole purpose is to give something which has no effect whatsoever, and to give whatever you're studying, and to see whether or not they have the same amount of side effects. Well, there's never been a placebo-controlled study, as far as I know, ever in the history of the United States, done on vaccines. However, there have been a couple that they claimed were placebo controls. What they did was they took the entire vaccine the way it's normally given, and that was the vaccine group, and then the placebo group was the entire vaccine with just the active parts removed. In other words, they left the thimerosal in, they left the monkey viruses in, they left the phenol in, they left the aluminum in, they left all of the different toxins in there. All they did was take out maybe the flu virus or the MMR virus. Everything else was left there. It's not a placebo. Placebo would have been sterile saline solution or lactated Ringer's glucose solution. That would be a placebo. That would be something we know doesn't cause a problem. So then when they had similar amounts of side effects, all they really proved was that the garbage that they put the vaccine active parts into are just as bad for everybody as the vaccine parts that are active. There's no placebo. I mean, if you want to do it correctly, you have to have a true placebo. So we really have a problem with a lot of the tests, even that the doctors believe were done. And again, I'm not putting the doctor down. The doctor doesn't know almost anything you've just learned just in the last however long we've been here, 40 minutes. So they don't realize what's going on. Pesticides, aluminum, phenol. Let's see. I want to make sure it wasn't anything that I was going to forget. I mentioned the birth hair. Parents are not being listened to. That's a big issue that really bothers a lot of people. One of the doctors that often lectures at the Autism Research Institute's Defeat Autism Now conferences, there's a couple statements that he makes over and over again, and it always gets a cute laugh from people, but it's not meant to be funny. I mean, it's a fact. And he'll say, the first three most important rules having to do with trying to help somebody get well, and of course he's at an autism conference, but you could say this no matter what group you were talking to and no matter what people they were treating, is number one, listen to the patient, not the lab results. Number two, listen to the patient, not the lab results. And number three, don't listen to the lab results, listen to the patient. And, you know, it's funny, but it's not funny because all day long I get new patients coming into my office, and what they usually tell me in many different areas, and it could be autism, it could be chronic fatigue, it could be fibromyalgia, is the doctor said there's nothing wrong with me, all the labs look fine, and I should go see a psychiatrist, or I should send my son to a psychiatrist, or my daughter a psychiatrist, because there really isn't anything wrong with me. And it would be so nice, and of course the patients that I see would like this even more than I do, because I have no problems in that regard, but it would be so nice if one of these science fiction devices, where you put a helmet on the patient that comes in, and you put a helmet on the doctor, and you throw a switch, and the way they're feeling changes over. And for 5 minutes, the doctor gets to feel exactly what it feels like to be in that patient's body, and the patient gets to feel the other, which is not the issue. And at the end of that 5 minutes, the doctor, who now, whatever, you know, is glassy and can't think straight, or hurts in every part of his body, or whatever it is the patient is feeling, when it switches back, that doctor no longer says, it's all in your head. That doctor goes, oh my Lord, I didn't know you felt that bad. We're going to have to look deeper. There's got to be something we can find. And of course, because they haven't been trained in clinical nutrition and environmental illness and a bunch of other things, they may not even know how to run the right test. They may not be able to find anything. But at least they'll stop saying something that's very anger-provoking to somebody who feels lousy, which is, it's all in your head. Your labs show me you're fine. You don't have chronic fatigue. You walked in here, didn't you? I mean, I am so tired of hearing all of my patients tell me what these stupid doctors have said to them. And of course, the doctor's not stupid. You can't get through medical school if you're stupid. But you can if you're ignorant. Because ignorant just means you don't know things that you should know. And there's a lot of things that medicine needs to know that they don't, so we have a lot of ignorance there. And that's the problem. And if we could switch that over, they still might not be able to help the people. But they wouldn't say, it's all in your head, go see a shrink, because they'd be able to feel it. And that would be very, very nice, because we really need to have some of that. So we always need to listen. Well, that happens in autism all the time. So somebody will say, my kid was developing completely normally until that MMR shot, or until that DPT shot. And the doctor, who wasn't in the house, who wasn't living there, who didn't bring the child up, will say, no, that's not possible. You just think it happened right about then. But it, well, of course you know when it happens. It's your kid. You know if all of a sudden a new problem occurs. And they just blow it off, which is totally ridiculous. The number that are born autistic is very low, but there isn't any very good research on that. Because, again, they don't want, they being the medical pharmaceutical complex, they do not want certain things to be known because it looks bad. So, for example, if they were to do a study where they took, which would be a really good idea, where they took, whatever, 1,000 newborns, and they purposely said, okay, for the first 2 months of their life, no vaccines. And we just take a look and we see how many autism cases are there out of 1,000. And they found, I don't know what they're going to find. Based on the Amish, they'd probably find none. But I guess if there's enough mercury in the mother's mouth or something, which is one of the, definitely one of the causes as far as I'm concerned, they might get a few. And then they go, okay, so we know that. We know very, very few, if any, were born autistic. And now they go ahead and start the vaccines, or maybe they start the vaccines on half of the 1,000 or half of the 5,000, bigger studies are better, and not the others, and then see what happens. They don't want to do that because that's too definitive. It's much easier to design a study that's going to show what you want than to design a really open-minded study like the one I just gave you a little peek at, which is going to make it very, very obvious. And they don't want obvious because billions of dollars are being made by vaccines. So we have a major, major problem. Vitamin D we just mentioned. Vitamin D, you should all, I mean, I now tell everybody, get your vitamin D tested. And it's the only vitamin test that doctors are beginning to do. There's one other one that some of them do with the elderly, which is vitamin B12, but they're looking in the wrong place because the vitamin B12 test is not the way you test for vitamin B12 accurately. You have to do a special test called methylmalonic acid. But vitamin D is finally being tested by a number of people now. And so I have people for the first time in my entire practice coming in for their first appointment, and they're bringing me lab results, and often, maybe even over 50% of the time, it already includes a vitamin D test. But they usually hand it to me, and they say, yeah, my doctor said everything's normal, but I've got your tests. And I take a look, and, you know, maybe their vitamin D is 34, and the reference range is 32 to 100. So it's not okay, it's just within the reference range. So that's something that's good, because vitamin D helps the neurological system in a number of ways, helps reduce multiple sclerosis risk, helps reduce, I think there are up to 7 different types of cancers so far that have been studied, where if your D level is high enough, your risk of that number of cancers is much lower. So very worthwhile, and of course you end up having a supplement to get it up there, and that means a couple of tests, because you supplement, and you know, you test it again 4 months later, and you see, is it moving? Is it going up far enough? And when it finally gets to, can't tell you exactly because they keep upping it on us as they find it should be higher. But let's say when it gets to 60 to 80, you drop down the amount you were taking to somewhere in the middle because you were taking an amount that was raising it. Now we want the amount that'll hold it there because we don't want it just to keep on going up forever, even though they don't know what a upper end is. Vitamin E, very, very, very helpful. So how about genetics? Where does genetics come in? Because genetics are sort of the medical profession, the profession's out. Oh, well, it's your genetics. I mean, it's not your fault that your son is autistic. It's not your fault that, you know, fill in the blank. It's genetic. Well, that sounds good, but if you actually were to come with me to some of the scientific conferences that I go to every year and listen to some of the genetic scientists, that's not what they say. It's not what the experts say. It's what's being released to the newspaper. It's what the people are writing up. It's what your doctor tells you. It's not what the experts in genetics are saying. The experts in genetics, PhD geneticist researchers, are telling us that your genetics are basically a predisposition possibility only. And that somewhere between 5, and I think I've heard as high as 12. I don't know if I've ever heard any geneticist go over 12%. Let's say even 15. 5 to 15%. Might be genetics. But that 5 to 15% is not, this is your genetic blueprint, you are going to get this condition. That's not what it is at all. They tell us, no, absolutely not. The 5 to 15% is, you have a higher likelihood of getting this or this if all the wrong things happen to happen and you're unlucky. And so maybe they can check your genetics, and they're called SNPs. Single nuclear polymorphisms. They're looking at specific parts of your gene. They take a look at that and they go, oh, because you have these particular SNPs, you have a higher likelihood, a greater likelihood of getting heart disease. Well, but that only means that you, even more than the general public, have to do the things that prevent heart disease. Problem, of course, is learning those. That's why I give my 9-week class all the time, so people can learn all these other different things. But all it says is you're more likely. So I have a patient who came to me when he was about 40, somewhere between 40 and 45. And every male member of his family, as far back as anybody had records of, so this is his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, his great-great-grandfather, every single one of them died of a heart attack prior to age 35. And he said, I don't want to be part of that. And so he started reading all sorts of books and finding out that cholesterol really wasn't a problem and you don't want to reduce it and what vitamins are the good idea and what different things to take like cod liver oil. He was taking a couple of different things. He was doing a pretty decent job for someone in the public that you know, was trying to sift through one person telling you one thing and somebody else telling you the opposite. And he made it to over 40 and was still feeling pretty good. And he said, I've decided I'd like to make it to 80 or 90. And so somebody said, you know, go see him. You're one of the people whose names kept on coming up. And so he enlisted my help to further expand the good things he was doing so that he could, you know, get rid of all these predispositions. Because, again, it's just increasing your likelihood. If you do all the right things, it won't happen. So with autism, what they're finding is that the child who gets autism, the children who get autism, have less of an ability to detoxify different substances, and less of an ability to what's called methylate. Methylation pathways have to do with taking different sulfur-bearing molecules, binding them onto poisons, and helping eliminate the poisons from the body. And the people that have a less ability to do that are more likely to get poisoned by the substance that some other person will be able to eliminate. Well, that shows up real well with that hair test. The kids that were able to process, even in the womb, the mercury that came in through the placenta from mom's fillings, that are coming off the fillings 24 hours a day, you can't stop it unless you get them taken out. And I should mention now, just to make sure it's on the tape, if somebody ever decides to get their silver fillings removed to get that mercury out of your body, do not go to the dentist that put them in. You have to find a properly trained, mercury-free dentist that does all the right things, because otherwise, while he or she is drilling them and vaporizing much more mercury than was happening when they were simply sitting there, you will put hundreds of times more mercury into your body. So they have to be done by a properly trained mercury-free dentist. There are a couple of different websites. In my class, I give out a bunch of different names. But one good organization that I'm a member of is the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. And their website is www.iaomt.org. You can come up after class if you need to get any of these again. And you can find a dentist in your area that has gone through their training and is properly trained. There's also an American Holistic Dental Association. There's something called DAMS, which is Dental Amalgam Mercury Syndrome. But you want somebody that uses the proper procedure, which at the very least, probably the single most important thing of everything they may do, because they all do slightly different things, but there's one that's the most important no matter what, and that is that the assistant that is standing next to the dentist has a high-pressure vacuum hose. Not the piece that's sitting in your palate sucking up saliva. That's not what I'm talking about. A high-pressure vacuum hose that they're holding right next to the drill burr so that everything that's being vaporized is being sucked in and going into a mercury filter, which is then a toxic waste and has to be paid toxic waste disposal fees to get rid of, and it's not just going into the air. So if you ever decide to do that, it's got to be done correctly. But that's what happened with the mercury here. Those children, those fetuses, weren't able to detoxify, and so they were more likely to become autistic. The ones who were able to detoxify, they processed it and shunned it out, and it ended up in the head hair. Well, that's fine. Hair is a good place for it. In your body is a bad place for it. Hair is outside of your body. So, you know, all these various different things, we just learn more and more and more all the time. In addition to which, when we're talking about DNA, we get instructed about DNA and about genetics as though it's not changeable. And it's not true. First of all, like I said, the genetic is just a predisposition. And what they say determines whether a predisposition, and the term that's used in genetics is expresses itself or does not, is, and it's always the same two things. Doesn't matter which geneticist is talking at which conference. Diet and lifestyle. So diet is diet. It's all the different things we eat. We're going to go into some of those things having to do with proper diets for autism. And lifestyle is basically everything else. You know, where do you live? Do you smoke? Do you drink? Do you care about organics and having less garbage on your food so you're getting the stuff that isn't loaded with pesticides? Do you love to just change your carpeting and change the colors of your walls, you know, every 3 or 4 years because, oh, you just have to change these things because it's neat to do. And every time you put in new carpet, that carpet outgasses more poisons for the next couple of years, which have actually gotten so many people sick that they, when they did this at the Environmental Protection Agency many years ago, so many EPA people got sick in Washington, D.C., that they had to pull the carpeting out and redo it. It was in the New York Times, it was in the Wall Street Journal, and, you know, it's horribly toxic. All of my sensitive patients, which would be, there are two acronyms for the people that are the most sensitive. One is EI, for they are environmentally ill. And the second is MCS, which is that they suffer from multiple chemical sensitivity. Those people, those men and women, would not be able to walk into a room if you had just bought a new piece of furniture, if somebody had a perfume on, if the place had been recarpeted in the last 4, 5, 6 months because there's still so many toxins coming out. All sorts of different things are releasing toxins all the time, and our body has to get rid of them. How many of those other toxins, besides mercury and other stuff that we know about, are a part of what may be the body burden that contributes in some way to autism? Don't know. Nobody's studying it. I have no idea. I mean, I know a lot of other different things that it causes because I'm busy treating people that have these things, but I have no idea how many other things there are that are in the mother and that are slowly going in through the placenta into the child, and that are part of the reason that that child can't process whichever toxins are then going to cause the autism, which in many cases are the assault of poisons injected in from the vaccines. So, you know, there's no question in my mind when people ask me which vaccines. Actually, I had a very interesting experience Sherry Tenpenny, who I know because I've taken some of her seminars and we've spoken many times, she ended up at one of the Defeat Autism Now conferences. Oh, I think this was probably 10 years ago. And I was sitting at a table with two osteopathic physicians that I knew because they had taken my class. And then they started sending me patients because they wanted to bring in my knowledge to their knowledge. And one of these was a woman who had recently adopted two children from another country. And so she's sitting at the table with me, and I see Dr. Tenpenny with her, you know, lunch coming through the line. And I yelled, "Sherry, come over here." And she came over. I introduced her to the other doctor. And immediately, the other doctor went, "Dr. Tenpenny," it's like, you know, you've got a celebrity there. And she said, I adopted these two kids, and because you can't adopt a child that hasn't been properly vaccinated, they've had their vaccinations so far. And my question is, now they're in my control, should I get them their next DPT shot?" Dr. Tenpenny said, "No." "Well, how about their next MMR shot?" Dr. Tenpenny said, "No." And she starts to do these things, and I said, "Can I save you some time? Sherry, which additional vaccines should she give to her children?" And Sherry said, "None." I said, "You see how much time I just saved you?" So it's just interesting. She would never vaccinate. I mean, I don't know if there's anything out there that she would give as a vaccine. People, every time a new one comes out, they come up with the ones on cervical cancer. They come up with the new types of flu shots. If somebody said, "I'll tell you what, I'll give you $100,000 if you'll allow yourself to be vaccinated," wouldn't do it. Because it's not worth my life for something that I might or might not be able to reverse for $100,000. It just isn't worth it. If somebody said, "I'll give you $10 million, I might do a whole bunch of homeopathic things that I know that seem to be able to increase your ability to prevent something, because I could help so many people with that money. I could fund my own research studies to get stuff done that I wanted. I could give my services away to people for free. The people that will do the things I want to do but have no money, I'd give them the supplements for free. I mean, if there was that much, I might have to think about it because of how many people I could help with it. But that's where it would probably have to be for me to be willing to be allow somebody to vaccinate me. And, you know, with the Patriot Act, we now have a government that passed a law that says that if they decide that it is within our best interests that everybody has to get, I don't know, fill in the blank, an anthrax shot, you know, whatever it might be, an Ebola shot, a flu shot for the swine flu or some new one that they're going to come out with, they have the right, which is very scary since the Patriot Act took our constitutional rights away, they have the right to say, if you don't want the shot, you're going into an internment camp. And I hope at some point some of those things will be reversed, because this is supposed to be a free country and it stopped being one. It would be nice to be able to get some of that stuff undone. But we'll see what happens with that. So the thing I was going into is that DNA can be changed. Now, the Pottinger Cat Study, I don't think we have a Pottinger book here, but Price Pottinger, our foundation, was founded on the work of two unbelievable scientists from many, many years ago, one of them being Francis Marion Pottinger Jr., who did a multi-year study using cats. You know, people use rats, they use mice, they use all sorts of different things. This was done with cats. And one of the things that, to me, I believe was the most important of all this different research was actually some of the things that were shown by the Pottinger Cat Study. We just had the Pottinger Cat books redone with a new cover and some additional information inside. And because my cats, Tomka and Kahlua, are ninth generation raw meat, which is what he found was the healthiest, was that you took five generations of feeding a perfect diet, and cats are obligate carnivores. It's raw meat and raw organs and bones. So we put my cats on the cover. So Kahlua doesn't realize that she's now a celebrity and that the two of them are on the back cover. But it's a fascinating story about what he found out with nutrition. But what he was found was that our diet can change DNA. Now, what was found was very, very specific, because if you fed diets which were not the healthiest diet, the animals started to lose different parts of health and they just started to go away. Their skin was not as good. Their emotional was not as good. They started fighting amongst themselves. Most people that have ever had cats know if you pick a cat upside down from about 4 feet up and drop it, it'll immediately right itself. They couldn't do that anymore as they started getting more and more unhealthy. Many, many different things started to happen. And you couldn't even get the fourth generation because before that they lost the ability to reproduce. And the way that it was proven, absolutely 100%, nobody can argue it, that the DNA changed, which of course we're actually right now, we're a big Price-Pottinger experiment, the population of our planet is a big Price-Pottinger experiment, was that if you took the cats after generation two that were still able to reproduce, they're immediately, as they're being born, even though you now put the newborn on a perfect diet, they're still not healthy. You put the newborn on a perfect diet, they're still not healthy because the DNA has been changed. We now have an unhealthy beginning. But what to me was the most fascinating was that somehow or other, and I assume human DNA is probably very, very similar, it knows what it's supposed to be like. And so if you took those that could still reproduce and you put them on a perfect diet, slowly, five generations, that's pretty slowly. Slowly, over five generations, they got all their health back. Somehow or other, the DNA or RNA or who knows what, I'm not a geneticist, knew what it was supposed to do. What was the plan? Feed me perfectly and I will correct the problems. And it slowly changed back and all the problems went away. So it would be so interesting. Obviously, with mice, a generation is like no time at all. With cats, a very healthy cat, super healthy cat, lives to be, you know, 20 to 25. Most cats live to be between 12 and 16. But they can reproduce in under 2 years. So you can have a multi-generational study in, you know, 8 or 10 years. You have a bunch of generations. Well, you can't do that with people. And besides which, we're not in internment camps and you're not in a cage. Okay, two of you are going to have sex today and you're going to do this. We can't do this. Nor can we make people eat in a certain way. Where you can make an animal eat in a certain way. They're in a cage. They eat what you're going to eat, what you're going to feed them. But it would be fascinating to get a bunch of people that wanted to do a Pottinger cat experiment and put them all in some community. It could be an island, but it wouldn't have to be. And feed them perfectly. We have only one problem. And if you think, you probably wouldn't think, have to think too hard to figure out what the problem is. 15 different experts will give you 15 different answers of what is the perfect food they should be getting. One group that doesn't know anything about history would say they need to be strict vegetarians or vegans. We have none on the planet Earth. There are no multi-generational vegan societies, so we know that can't be correct, because if it was correct, we would have some multi-generational vegan societies. And there are various stages of vegetarianism, and some people eat only meat in some areas, and some people eat a whole bunch of other different vegetables. And, you know, what Weston Price found, which is the other book that we keep alive, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, we just call it NPD, and obviously they're all available, you know, here at the foundation or from ppnf.org. He lived with these different societies around the world, and he wanted to do exactly the opposite of what our medical research does. Medical research says, if I give you this drug, does it help this particular symptom? He said, I don't want to know what drugs help symptoms. I want to know which people are the healthiest and why. Gee, I like that idea. So he went traveling around to where there was no electricity. Some people used fire and cooked, some people didn't. But they were far away and still eating their traditional diet that their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents, ancestors, whatever, had been eating. And he lived with the ones that had perfect health. And he studied what they were eating, and he reported on it in the book. And they're very varied, because depending on where you are, different meats are available, different fish are available, different poultry are available, different things that you can milk are available, different types of vegetables are available, different types of grains may be grown, but if you go back far enough, we didn't grow grains, because we were hunter-gatherers, we weren't growers. And he showed what they were all eating. Well, that's the way to do things. And so if we could... Maybe we need to have three different experiments. Maybe we need to have three different communities and pick three different experts is what the people should be eating and see if we can get three or four generations, five would be better, and see whether by the fourth or fifth generation we've got no overweight, we've got no need for glasses, we've got no or little probably no cancers. We've got no arthritis. All the other chronic diseases, various different chronic fatigue syndromes, different pain syndromes, different autoimmune conditions, probably none of them would be there. And when our last cats died before the two we have now, I decided I wanted Pottinger cats. Well, of course, Dr. Pottinger's been dead for a long time. What I really meant when I said that is I want fifth generation or more perfectly fed cats. And with cats, we know cats are obligate carnivores, so it's easier to know what a cat would get in the wild, whatever they can kill and eat. And if they're going to get any vegetable matter at all, it's either going to be the tiny amount that was in the stomach of something they ate, or a cat will chew some grass if it wants to make itself throw up for a hairball or something. Otherwise, they get no vegetables at all. So this woman decided, a PhD up in Westlake Village, Celeste Arnell, she decided, I want to do that. I want to pick a breed of cats that I like, and we're going to do five generations of as close as I can do in, you know, humanity and industrial world to a perfect diet, and see what happens. And she said by the time she got to the fifth generation, she had won so many best of cat shows. My girls are never going to a show. I'm not going to put them in front of people, make them be around all these people yelling and everything. But she'd won so many best of cat shows, she kept on going. And she said one of the things that the comments she kept on getting was the judge would pick the cat up, and Tonkinese are a very small breed. So a full-grown Tonkinese female weighs between 6 and 8 pounds. Full-grown Tonkinese male weighs between 7 and 10 pounds. So my cats are 7.6 pounds each. They're littermates. They're sisters. And they pick the cat up and they go, what are these cats made of, lead? Well, if you feed perfect food, even though they're not running around exercising and going to the gym, they have very good musculature and they don't have any fat. Or they have the amount they're supposed to have. So they're very solid. So she just kept on going. And when I found her, she was up to generation 9. So my girls are 9th generation raw meat. And it's just sort of neat. So people pet them and they go, wow, that feels different. That feels much softer than any other similar breed cat I've ever felt. And none of my patients, no matter how violently they're allergic to cats, are allergic to these girls. So I have people that can't be in a room for 10 minutes without either sneezing or having a runny nose or starting to itch or all sorts of different things. And they come over and they go, are the girls awake? Could I pet one of the girls? They're the only cats that I can hold in my lap and pet. What's going on? Well, you're not allergic to the species cat. You're allergic to the dander. You're allergic to the hair. You're allergic to the saliva and the lick. Well, but those are all exudates. Those are things that come out. Gee, I wonder if when we eat differently, what comes out is different. So because they're eating perfectly for over five generations, all these people that are violently allergic to cats have no allergies to my girls. So what we eat is very, very, very important. So DNA can change, and it can change back again. How many generations? How much do we have to do that? There's some DNA testing going on now, which I have to follow. I've got to find where it is. I've been told about it. I've been going to a bunch of energy workshops where they've said that they can alter DNA with just diets and energy. I have to validate that. I don't know if that's true, but it wouldn't surprise me. Energy, everything is energy. So the point is, anybody that says something can't be treated hasn't tried hard enough. So it's definitely changeable. Let's go over some of the things that we actually do to treat autism. And the chart that I handed out is the parent ratings. Because if you want accuracy, you don't ask the doctor what he or she believes. You ask the parents what they observed. Because they know their kids better than the doctor ever will, unless the doctor is the parent. There are more of them up here if anybody wants them. So this is always redone from the Autism Research Institute, and they always hand them out, or they're in their different handouts. And basically what they want to look at is, of all of the different, and they're called interventions, that we can do with an autistic patient, which are the ones that work, which have the most likelihood of benefit, which have the highest likelihood of causing problems. And so, you know, on the left side, you've got basically a bunch of different drugs, and you have what percentage. And they're all broken up in categories as far as what percentage got help, what percentage had no difference, what percentage were hurt or had side effects. And you'll notice if you go to the bottom section on the left side, or anywhere, but I started on the left, that if you want things that you can give the child, which almost never caused any problems, and which had a very high likelihood of causing benefits, those were all nutrients, not drugs. So this is all compiled so people can understand what I like this best, especially in a group like this, or the fact that this is being recorded. And I'm sure you can contact, you being whoever's listening to this tape, the Autism Research Institute, and say you would like a copy of the parent ratings of behavioral effects of biomedical interventions. So if somebody wants to try some things with their autistic child, and they don't have any doctor in their area that they like, they can't find a nutritionist or a health professional that knows anything about autism, then what you'd do is you'd look at that chart and you'd say, well, let's take five or six nutrients that have almost no record of side effects, the ones in which the number of people that had a problem was like, you know, 0 to 5%, and that had a very large number of people in which the kids got benefits. And let's bring those in one at a time. One at a time, very important. People don't understand that. People will start five different things. They'll have a reaction with their child, and they'll stop it all. You don't want to do that. You've got a child that is overly sensitive already. And therefore, you want to bring things in very slowly so you know which one causes a problem or which food causes a problem. We're going to go over foods in a few minutes. So you can say, ah, nope, that's not good. Let's stop that one. You bring in five things at a time and you have a problem, and you go, to heck with this, I'm not going to do it, and now your child doesn't get the benefit of all the things that you would have been able to help them with because you said, I don't want to do this, because when you tried it, you got a problem. So you pick one thing, whichever it might be. A good beginning would actually be DMG, dimethylglycine. It looks like it's about eighth or ninth down on the list there. DMG is a completely non-toxic substance, which has, in the eyes of some people, helped more autistic children to begin to talk than any other substance out there. And the research studies that were done on it about 35 years ago, if I remember correctly, the chemists said it had the toxicity of water. In other words, zero. But it has two methyl groups, dimethylglycine. In an hour ago I said methylation is one of the things that the children can't do. So this helps the body to be able to gently detox. And dimethylglycine was originally developed, and it's a chemical that exists, but it was made as a supplement by one company. It's the only company I ever use. It's called Food Science of Vermont. And although they have it in three or four different forms, for autism, I always recommend people find, and you'll probably have to order it online because the stores don't carry it this way, I recommend you order the DMG in liquid drops, because that's just pure DMG and distilled water. There are no preservatives, no additives, no tableting compounds, all the things that maybe your child might react to, and you'll think it was the DMG. So we want just the DMG. That's in the liquid drops. Food Science of Vermont, DMG drops. And, you know, you give the kid maybe five or six drops, and you see whether you notice any changes in his behavior for the next day or so to make sure that it's not a problem. I'm only looking for problems at the beginning. No problem? Okay. So give him five drops three times a day for a couple days. No problem? All right. Depending on how much the child weighs, because everything should be dosed by body weight, there's a dropper in there, and the dropper is divided in a half a milliliter and a full milliliter. And so if you've got a kid that weighs, I don't know, let's say 50 pounds, we consider 50 pounds to be a third of an adult. Because an average adult, whatever average is, I hate that word, is somewhere around 150, 160 pounds. So that's a third of an adult. So I would probably give a child that weighs 50 pounds, and I just tried five drops, didn't do anything, five drops three times a day for a couple days, no problems. I would probably put them on about one half of an ml, which would be about half of that dropper. This is what I would do in my office. Obviously, I'm not prescribing to people I don't know. I don't even know who your kids are. I don't even know how many people in the room here have autistic kids that you know. But after I tried a couple low doses and was sure that it was not going to cause a detox reaction too fast or anything, I would probably do a half an ml once a day for a week. And if it caused no problems, I would try to do it twice a day. And if that caused no problems, I would just leave the kid on a half an ml twice a day for the next few months. And then I'd say, okay, what's the next thing on here that looks like it has almost no problems and lots of benefits? And I'd pick another one, and I'd use a slow dose, and I'd start bringing in some of these things. And you might pick up a book that's called The Real Vitamin and Mineral Book by Dr. Shari Lieberman. She goes over a lot of vitamins, a lot of minerals. This is not a book on autism. It's just a vitamin mineral book. We carry it at the foundation. And she'll go over doses with you to give you some idea, and then you can break it down to what you would use for a smaller child and start even lower because we don't want reactions. Figure out what a third of an adult would be if your child's 50 pounds and cut it lower than that because we don't want different reactions. Joan's bringing up a copy of the book. I love Dr. Lieberman. She's a fabulous researcher and a great author. She's called The Real Vitamin and Mineral Book. And you slowly start bringing some of these different things in. And all of a sudden, after the child is on, 3, no problem. 4, no problem. 5, oops. Child doesn't seem to like that last one you brought in. Okay, bring that back out again. Well, gee, you read a book that says this is so good for kids. Okay, maybe you want to try it again at a lower dose. Because remember, if it's something that's necessary, but it's helping a detox pathway, so the body's starting to detox, and so the reason you're seeing a reaction is because something that you want the child to be able to expel is being expelled, but too quickly. So we do it more slowly. So sometimes you just slow it down. But, you know, you just slowly start bringing these things in. And I always implore people, if you can find somebody in your area that knows what they're doing, you're much better off. Because we don't want to cause a bunch of imbalances. You won't do that with DMG. But if you start bringing in a B vitamin, and you bring in a bunch of, let's say, B6 and B12 that's used a lot, you really generally want to have the other Bs in there also. So you try to find a multi. You can't find a multi. Every time you give the kid a multi, they react. Okay, so you find a real low-dose multiple B that isn't a true multi because it doesn't have all the other different things in. It's just got B1, B2, B3, B6, B12, you know, B9, pantothenic acid. And a small amount of that, and then you add a little bit more B6. There are a whole bunch of different ways. But the point is, there are a lot of things that you can do, and as long as you do them one at a time, and as long as you remember the golden rule, which is that it can take up to a week. It can take longer, but it's rare. For a substance that's new to the body to cause the reaction that you're going to see. So you don't ever do something immediately and then start another one tomorrow. Yes, John? Sure, very good. She said, would I describe what a reaction is? A reaction is very simply anything that isn't normal for your child. And I get this all the time. Somebody says, well, you said that if there's a reaction, what's a reaction? I go, I can't tell you how your child's going to be reacting. One of them is going to get hyper. The other one's going to be sleeping all day. The other one's going to be screaming with his hyper. The other one's going to get asthma. The other one's going to get a skin condition. A reaction is, wait a minute, why is he doing that? Oh, we just started this new thing 3 days ago. It might be that. Stop it. It goes away. No, I'm not sure that was it. Start it again. It comes back. Okay. We've affirmed it. That's the problem. Now you can either try a lower dose or stop that one and try something else. Reaction is anything different. Especially with an autistic kid. With people where we're doing detox, it's real easy. A reaction is always either fatigue, headaches, loose stool, or a skin condition. But with autistic kids, it's usually some kind of acting up. It's something that they were doing. It's something that's like something got worse. Whatever it is you don't like that you wish wasn't happening, well, it's worse than it was before. Or something that they've done a couple times and you're glad they're not doing it anymore. Oh, darn, they're doing it again. Okay, so anything that's different that you're not used to or that you're used to but it's not as bad and now it just got worse, that's a reaction. So stop it. It goes away. You're not convinced because sometimes it happens. Start it again. It comes right back within a couple of days. Okay, that's it. You can either say, let's try this again at a lower dose because maybe we just use too much. Or you could say, well, let's shelf that one for a while and try the next nutrient. So, I mean, there are all sorts of different things that you can do there that make huge, huge differences. The one thing you must never, ever forget is actually two things. One is that 5-day rule. You can't start another new thing if after 3 days it doesn't look there's a problem. Because if the problem was going to start on day number 4 or 5, and now we add another new thing, and that causes a problem, no, you don't know that caused the problem. It could be the last one just built up. So you always want to wait at least 5 days. Some adults and some children, not too many, a couple, it takes longer. And you'll find that out because all of a sudden you haven't changed anything for a week and a half and some behavior just changed majorly, look at the last thing you changed. Stop it. If it goes away, your child takes even longer for it to build up. Maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 days. You may have to do it, make a change every 2 weeks. Usually a week is sufficient. The other thing is food is the most important thing that everybody is doing wrong. Absolutely, grade A, number one screw up is always food. And this is where I have a little problem with the Autism Research Institute, because they've got one part right and the other part wrong, and we need both parts right. And there are two issues as far as food is concerned. One issue is we want to eliminate what we call trigger foods. That's any kind of food that triggers something. Usually it's behavior with autistic, but anything that triggers something. So there are specific foods that are most likely to trigger, and it's not just in autism, it's in our population. It's just that they're even more sensitive. And the foods that are most likely to trigger problems in general appear to be wheat, but gluten in particular. So some can use other types of grains that don't have wheat, others that don't have gluten. Others, anything that has gluten has to be removed. So wheat absolutely needs to go away. If you've got an autistic child and you're allowing that autistic child to have anything with wheat in it, you're doing your child a disservice. They are never going to be able to get the benefits that they would be able to get because their body is in overdrive from the inflammatory effects of the wheat. And there's plenty of people that aren't autistic that would be better off if they didn't have wheat also. But in general, that's one major one. So whether it's in a cake or a cookie or a cracker, you know, or a pasta, or whether somebody puts one little tiny amount of flour in to thicken up your soup, or whether it's in the sauce that somebody bought somewhere, or whether it's in the salad dressing and you didn't realize it was there, or whether you're at a restaurant and you put on some soy sauce, every soy sauce sold in the United States contains wheat. And it's on the label. If you want a soy type sauce that doesn't say soy sauce, that tastes very similar but it's stronger, so you have to use less, then you can use wheat-free tamari. But you can't get wheat-free soy. You can only get wheat-free tamari. Tamari is a higher quality, better, and basically even thicker and stronger soy sauce. So if you want to do that, because if you like the flavor of it, then you want whichever, there are a couple of different brands out there, Oshawa, Mitsutoko, and you want the one that says it's aged. So on the side of the bottle, they tell you a little story. All of our sauces are aged for, you know, X number of moons in a wooden cask. Okay, you want it to be aged, because then it's fermenting. It won't say fermented, it says aged. You want the ones that say aged, and you want the ones that say wheat-free. And while you're at it, go one step and make it organic so it's not genetically modified. So organic, aged, and wheat-free tamari, not regular soy sauce. And I have people that like Chinese restaurants, and the people at the Chinese restaurants, probably the cooks, may think they're crazy, but they go in and they say, I'm allergic to soy sauce. Don't put any soy sauce on any of my products when you're cooking it. I know there may be a tiny residue, you know, in your wok when you're cooking it, but, you know, wipe it out before you make mine. Don't put any soy sauce. And they keep a dropper in their pocket or their purse of wheat-free organic aged tamari because they like the flavor, and they put it on themselves. So all sorts of different things you can do. So wheat, major one. Lots and lots of people react to wheat. Another one is pasteurized dairy and occasionally all dairy. Many people on what they call the autism spectrum, which is all the people that are working or treating or doing anything with kids with autism, have been told that dairy is a no-no. Stay away from all dairy. I haven't found that's always true. It just depends on the child. You can't know without checking yourself. So first, of course, you've got to get enough benefits that you can see your child's got some improvement, and then you say, okay, we're going to try something and see whether or not it's a trigger. But if you want to do that with dairy, you want the cleanest, highest quality dairy you can get, which luckily here in San Diego or in Southern California, we have two very high quality clean milks. One is called Clarivale, which is in northern area of San Diego County, so Orange County and Los Angeles. And the one that we have down here is called Organic Pastures. And they're both organic, and they are totally free-range, cows walking around outside eating grass and hay, not eating all sorts of various different grains, which is not what a cow should eat. And if you get that in the form of whole, raw milk, very easy, grade A, whole, raw milk, Organic Pastures, or again, in Orange County and L.A. County, Clarivale, And if you don't heat it, because remember, raw is only raw if you leave it raw. And that may sound like, well, okay, that was pretty stupid. Of course raw is only raw. You have no idea how many people call me up and they say, I don't understand. You've changed my entire family's health. Everybody can drink milk now. Nobody has reactions. Their noses aren't running. Their asthma's gone. Their peeling skin is gone. And we all got our symptoms back last week. And I said, what'd you do? Well, we had raw milk. And I'm thinking, no, they didn't. What'd they do? And it's always been somebody cooking with raw milk. So the one that I remember was somebody made New England clam chowder. She said, I made New England clam chowder with the raw milk. And I'm thinking, okay, is she going to catch what she just said to me, or am I going to have to tell her? I said, you made New England clam chowder with raw milk. She said, yes, that's what I just said. And my family all reacted. I said, what makes raw milk raw milk? Well, the fact is it's never been heated. Okay. How did you make New England clam chowder without heating it? Oh, jeez. You know, we have different levels of being able to understand. She just figured this container of milk that says raw organic pastures, whole grass-fed milk, has never caused my family a problem, and she'd never made clam chowder since they switched over. So she made some clam chowder, cooked it up, it's boiling. Boiling point is 212 degrees. That's way higher than pasteurization. She ultra-pasteurized the milk. And, of course, everybody had a reaction. So just, you know, simple thing, raw is raw if you leave it raw. So for some people, the raw milk isn't a problem. For some people, they really have a true dairy intolerance, and even if it's raw, they can't use it. But you don't know that until you've gotten your child at a level position. You see exactly what's going on, and instead of a particular nutrient, you say, okay, we're going to try a little bit of raw milk a couple times a day and see what happens. And, you know, if it works and it's not a problem, you've found another very good protein and very good fat. Because if we have good quality raw milk, it's a very healthy food. But if it's not, if it is a problem for somebody, that one goes out. So we've got dairy, we've got wheat. Often we have gluten, which is in lots of other grains also. Sometimes you just cut out most of the grains, except the few that are gluten-free. And I'm going to go over those in a second. But first, soy causes a lot of problems to a lot of kids. And sugar, and anything that quickly turns to sugar, causes a lot of problems to a lot of kids. Now, this is where we get in the issue between a trigger food and an unhealthy food. Trigger food is an actual specific food. The body says, I don't like that food. I'm reacting to that food. That's a trigger food. You could call it an allergy. You could call it a food intolerance. Trigger is a little bit more accurate. It triggers something. In many cases, it triggers a bad behavior. And that's generally wheat or gluten, pasteurized, and possibly even raw dairy, gluten in all sorts of different grains, not just the wheat, soy products, and in some cases, certain chemicals. So I've seen a number of kids, for example, where one of their triggers is red dye. Another kid's trigger is blue dye. Another kid's trigger is some other chemical that's used as a preservative. Those are triggers. They may not be good for anybody, but those are triggers. Now, we've got another huge area, and that's foods which are not a specific trigger. They simply do something which makes it harder for the body to handle anything. And that is foods which destabilize the blood sugar. And that means almost all sweets, all flour. Beans are nowhere near as bad because they don't convert quite as quickly, but for some they're a problem, for some they're not. And I don't have to add the third category because I hope your kids are not drinking alcohol, because it's starches, sugars, and alcohols. So the sugars are real easy. The sugars are basically anything that tastes sweet that's any kind of sugar. So we're talking about maltose and lactose and sucrose and all the various different ones. And the artificial sweeteners are phenomenally worse because we're talking about a child who already can't properly metabolize poisons, and those are all poisons. They don't exist in nature. We had to make them in a lab, including the ones they claim to be natural. You know, NutraSweet is natural because we make it of naturally occurring amino acids. Wrong. Body can't do that. You got to do it in a lab. Sucralose is natural. No, it's not. Anything that has to be made in a lab is not natural, and the body can't deal with it. So all the artificial sweeteners are out, but you shouldn't use anything artificial anyway. We're not looking for things that are going to trigger a problem. So we're trying to get these all as low as possible. And the issue, which is huge, is that most families, and this is even more true when there's an autistic child in the family. The parents are not parents. They've turned the child into the parent. And until you reverse that, you will never get all the benefits that you are able to get. It will never happen. Until you become the parent and you stop letting the child be the parent, you will never get anywhere near the amount of benefits. I have people that tell me, I can't pull the sweets away. He's going to throw a temper tantrum. Okay, then what are you doing in my office? How am I going to help you? I mean, if somebody said, but my child likes to put his hand in to the snake pit where the cobra is. And if I make him, oh, well, I mean, if it was going to kill him, I'd stop him. Oh, but if instead it's going to keep him autistic instead of helping him get back to normal, you won't? I mean, where do we put the dividing line of what things are important enough for us to say, I'm going to get a lot of screaming, which is one of the things I don't want. I understand that's one of the things we're trying to get rid of, but we're bringing that in not because it's a tantrum because of autism. We're bringing it in because we're taking away a very harmful food that the child likes. We're the ones that, you know, inadvertently, we didn't know, we ended up getting the child to like these foods. We didn't realize how bad they were. How about stevia? Stevia is a sweetener that I haven't seen any problem with except in two people in 20 years. So stevia I have no problem with. The only issue I have with stevia is not an issue with stevia. It's that if you are going to be successful in making it much less likely that your child or yourselves are going to be eating more sweets than you need to and getting the wrong ones, we have to tone down the sweet tooth. And if we keep on bringing in a healthier sweet, sweet tooth never goes away. And so every time the child is away from you and there's something that's going to send them into fits, that's going to take you 2 weeks to try to slowly clear out of his body, he's going to eat it because you kept perpetuating the sweet tooth. So yes, absolutely, stevia is a healthy sweet, as is Yacon, Y-A-C-O-N, as is Mamortica, which is Lohan. I mean, there are a couple of natural sweeteners that don't cause the problems, but they do perpetuate the sweet tooth. So if you were going to use a sweetener, probably stevia would be one of the best ones. Yacon would be another one, if you can find it. But you're perpetuating a sweet tooth. So all of the things that turn to sweet are A, the ones which are already sweet, and B, the things which the body rapidly turns into sugar. And that is basically flour. If we take a grain, every grain has a different speed of conversion by your body into sugar. The fastest converting grain is rice. So just about the worst possible thing you can do, and people are doing it all the time because of lack of knowledge, you know, that's one of the reasons I decided to do this lecture, is, well, we're going to use bread made out of rice flour. You might as well give them a candy bar. Because that's how fast the rice flour is going to turn into sugar. And one of the things that causes the behavior we're trying to get rid of is a blood sugar response. So we want to take out the trigger foods, and we want to normalize the blood sugar. So rice flour, tapioca flour, and the vegetable, which is pure starch, potato flour, you might as well just feed a candy bar. That's how fast they convert. And that's my big issue with the Autism Research Institute, is because if you go into their exhibit hall, the entire exhibit hall is filled with different vendors that are giving all the parents non-trigger foods that are sweet as heck and pure starch. So they're putting in erythritol and xylitol and stevia, holding on to the sweet tooth we need to get rid of, and they're making cakes and cookies and muffins and breads and pastas with rice flour and tapioca flour and potato flour, and all of those things turn right into sugar. And if the blood sugar is going like this, we're never going to get all the healing effects we want. We really need to be on more of what has been called a Paleolithic diet. It's been inappropriately called an Atkins diet because it was around way before Robert Atkins ever started putting patients on it. We basically want to have adequate amounts of animal proteins. If you find an animal protein that the child's allergic to, cut that one out. Adequate amounts of fats. Never tell nature that she's stupid. Every time we tell nature she's stupid, we lose. If you're religious, Don't tell God he or she or it is stupid. Same thing. We lose. So neither of those, neither any God that may or may not be there or any Mother Nature that may or may not be in the earth, neither of them produced eggs without yolks. Neither of them produced chicken without skin. Neither of them produced dairy fat, dairy products without butter fat. Neither of them produced beef, you know, without any fat on the outside. Leave it the way it is. Try to get the stuff that nature raised. It's a little harder. Some people can't afford it. So we want free-range organic when we can afford it. We want grass-fed beef because all the fats are wrong if it ate grains. So anytime we can, we want what we're eating to have been eating what it was supposed to be eating. We got to go that extra step. Otherwise, we can't be eating better if what we're eating wasn't eating better. So most people don't go that extra step. They buy organic. Well, okay, organic beef means that the cattle, all day long, were eating organic grains. Cattle don't eat grain. They don't know how to farm, and they have no stores to buy from. So therefore, organic isn't always better. If I had the choice between organic beef and grass-fed beef from a neighboring farm where he couldn't afford to get certified organic, I'll take the grass-fed. He's not spraying his grass with pesticides. He's not spraying them with herbicides to see if he can knock them down. He wants them to grow so that they're going to be there to be eaten. But, you know, maybe he can't afford to get it certified organic. Okay, I still want the grass-fed first. Obviously, I prefer both. If I can get grass-fed and organic, that's terrific. But we want to normalize the blood sugar as much as possible. That means every meal should be good quality proteins and good quality fats. Most often animal fats do that much better. Most often animal proteins do that much better. But if somebody's going to use any kind of vegetable fat, the vegetable fats that seem to be the healthiest are olive oil. That everybody knows. And then the other two, most people, unless they've read some stuff, think are bad for them. The other two very healthy oils are coconut oil and palm kernel oil, as long as they haven't been improperly processed. So that's what we want to start doing to regulate out the diet. And I've got lots of people. If you get on my website, if you just go to davidgetoff.com, and the only way you get sidetracked is if somebody doesn't know how to spell get or doesn't know how to spell off. And, you know, everybody always laughs at that, but you'd be amazed how many people decide that get off, that I'm going to have two T's and get, or one F and off, because it couldn't possibly just be get and off. Well, sorry, it is. And it'll redirect you to the actual site, which is Naturopath for You. And somewhere on there, there's a button that says, I think, 21-day or 3-week super healthy diet. And that's basically the diet that I would want somebody to put their kid on for 3 weeks. Because 3 weeks is enough time, usually 2 weeks is about enough time, to clear out all the garbage. If there's any particular food that you know is a problem, and I've got it allowed, clear it out. And anything you know, clear it out. But we would do that for 3 weeks. By the second week, and sometimes before that, all the bad stuff is out. And then so the third week, you get to see what kind of changes are diet-related only. And when people call me up and they say, I was referred to you, and I want you to help put my son, on your autism program. Well, it's not an autism program, because everybody gets treated differently. They're all different. They could be on 5 different sets of supplements. But I go, well, I'd be happy to do that. I mean, I'm booked up. You'll have to wait a couple months to get in, but that's fine. I'll send you all the paperwork. But you need to understand, if you haven't been to my website yet and learned some of this, or if the person that referred you didn't tell you this, that you must, absolutely must, or I'm not interested in working with you. I've got too many people waiting that are going to do this. You must be willing to completely change the diet of the child, regardless of how much he's going to scream and yell that he doesn't like this. Because lots of what we're trying to overcome is occurring from the food. And as I say in my classes, if somebody comes by your house every day, some gang of kids, and they throw rocks at your window, and they break your windows. So you call a glazier up, and he comes over, and he replaces the windows. And so the next week, up, they came again, they break your windows again. So this time they come up, they put a heavier grade glass up. Oh, the kids find that out. The first window, they're not broken. Next week, they come up with bigger rocks, they break it again. And then you put up plexiglass, and they start scraping the plexiglass so you can't see at it. You're not addressing the problem. The problem is the kids and the rocks, not that the window wasn't strong enough. Well, very often, the wrong food can be the biggest part of what is not allowing your kid to get as much healing as he would otherwise be able to get. way more than the supplements. The supplements are not going to help as much unless we change the diet, but the diet will help a lot even without the supplements. So diet is major. And then the supplements do additional good things. Well, another very, very important thing is pulling out toxic metals. Because in many, many, many kids, the toxic metals were a big problem. They might have come out of the mother's fillings. In some cases, they come out of the kid's fillings because the parents didn't know. Kid gets a cavity, and they put a silver filling, which is 52% mercury, in the autistic kid. If I was a benevolent dictator, that dentist would go to jail. But then on the other hand, he probably didn't know. She probably didn't know. So, you know, how do you penalize somebody for doing something they don't realize is bad? But in enough kids, heavy metals are a problem, that one of the standard therapies for autism has to do with pulling out heavy metals. And to bind and remove, there's a word for it in English, it's called chelate. Chelate is to bind, and then we pull it out. Doesn't matter how you're doing it, it's still called chelation. I don't personally believe in using any of the drugs to chelate, because they're too aggressive, they pull too fast, and I've seen too many people that have said, oh yeah, my God, the dentist we went to, health professional we went to, did some metal testing, and sent my kid off the deep end when they gave this thing to see if it would pull heavy metals out. I do very, very slow heavy metal detoxification. One of the products I use, I brought in just so people could look at it. It's called ACZ, which stands for Advanced Cellular Zeolite, but it doesn't matter what it stands for because the label says ACZ Nano. And it simply goes in. It's very easy to adjust the dose. We can use sprays. If a spray is too much, I put it in a dropper bottle. We use drops. And it just gently and slowly binds lead, mercury, cadmium, nickel, arsenic, and pulls them out of the body, and they come out in urine, they come out in stool, and so we slowly start pulling out all the different heavy metals. So there's all sorts of different things, but absolutely, I would say a very large percentage, part of it is toxic metals, and we have to pull them out super slowly. So that's one of the things I use three or four different ones to pull out. Another thing, if you look on the list of things that are very, very helpful from the Autism Research Institute, another thing that has very little of any problems and a lot of major helps is cod liver oil. Cod liver oil is phenomenal. It brings in the omega-3, the essential fatty acids that are very, very helpful. I take a tablespoon of cod liver oil every day. I have for, I don't know, at this point, 20 years. I have probably every single patient in my practice on cod liver oil, unless maybe they can't be on it yet because they just came in to see me and I have to support their liver for a while first. But again, we start at a very low dose. So if I say a tablespoon for an adult, then a 50-pound child would be a teaspoon, because there are three teaspoons in a tablespoon. I'm always amazed at how many people, hello, little bugger. I always like things flying around my... I mean, generally, I don't like to kill anything, but on the other hand, a lot of people don't like bugs. A lot of people that don't cook don't know all the various different measures. So, you know, 2 tablespoons in an ounce, 3 teaspoons in a tablespoon. So that makes it easy. If we've got 3 teaspoons in a tablespoon, and if an adult dose is generally a tablespoon, then a third of an adult or a 50-pound kid would be a teaspoon. But again, start slow. Use a half a teaspoon if you've got a 50-pound kid. Wait a week. No problem? Okay. Bring it up to a teaspoon. And just so you'll know, another little tidbit of information that's helpful, it is less likely to give a side effect if you increase the frequency than it is if you increase the dose. So what do I mean? Let's say you've been giving a certain amount of anything, I don't care what it is, and now you'd like to try more. If you have just started it, so you've got the smallest amount now, and you feel, okay, let's double that. Don't give twice as much now. Give the same amount as another time a day. So instead of going from a half a teaspoon to a teaspoon, you go from a half a teaspoon once a day to a half a teaspoon twice a day. That way, instead of pushing twice as hard, you're just starting again to push at another time. And the easy way to remember that, to make it sink in as to why, well, of course that makes sense, is if somebody were to hit you maybe 10% less force than it would take to really hurt, and then 20 minutes later they did it again, it still wouldn't hurt. But if they hit you twice as hard now, remember it was only 10% less than it would take to hurt, twice as hard now, it's going to hurt a lot. So you're pushing the body more gently in a way that doesn't cause problems if you do it again at another time of day. So that's always the way to do it. Anytime you're doing something, and you know, if you don't, if you go, well, let's just do twice, and there's a problem, that doesn't mean you can't do twice as much. Try now doing half as much twice. I even have people where they've done that. They did once, no problem. They did that same amount another time of day, no problem. And it's helped, and they've seen improvements, and they'd really like to try more. And so they bring one of those doses up to twice as much, and they have a problem. And they call me up, and they go, I guess I can't do any more. I go, we don't know that yet. Try three times. Do another time in the middle, instead of bringing either of those up. So we can always do those things, and that's a very, very important way to bring things up again. Something else that's really important is just a child's general immune system. And of all the different substances that are on the list here from Autism Research Institute, one of the ones that's often been shown to be helpful is a substance called colostrum. Even kids that have dairy intolerances, most often, there's nothing written in stone. Anything depends on your child. But most often, don't react to a good grade of colostrum. There are a lot of colostrums on the market. Most of them are really bad. The more they advertise, in general, the worse they are. Well, wait a minute. That doesn't make any sense. Sure it does. The money's all going into advertising, not into the product. So my favorite colostrum is made by Immutech, I-M-U-T-E-K. And it's called Immuno 5. You can get it both as a powder and as a capsule. You'll probably have to get it from Immutech's website or go look for it online. The health food stores, they just haven't gotten into the health food stores. They don't have a lot. Second best after that, in my opinion, is called Percoba. P-E-R-C-O-B, as in boy, A. And those two are so much better than most else of what's on the market that unless you can't get either of them, which hopefully will never happen, I wouldn't go to number three. Because number three, in my opinion, is Symbiotics New Life, and is so far down below that I don't even have it in my office. I carry Immutech, and if I can't get Immutech, I have Percoba. But again, you try it, and you use it, and you see what happens. If there's a problem, you switch away from it. And that's a very good, gentle immune booster. And there are a lot of other different things. I have special ones in my office that you can't find that are extracts of colostrum. I do all sorts of different things. Echinacea is a good immune product. There's a great company called Herbalist and Alchemist. Their products are carried in some health food stores in some states, but not in California. So you have to get online and put Herbalist and Alchemist into Google and get on their website. They'll send you a catalog or you can get it online. You can order the stuff directly from them. They've got a product called Healthy Kids Compound. And it's a combination of echinacea and some other different things. Their directions are correct. And if your kid's getting sick all the time, you might try that. If there's no reaction, you can have the appropriate dose right off the label of that daily just to keep the kid doing better throughout the year. There's another product which I haven't been using a lot lately on autism, but I need to start testing to see whether or not it would be work and would be appropriate. And it's a single capsule where you just take one of these things once a day. We don't really have to change body weight because that doesn't seem to make any difference. And the name just jumped out of my head. What's the product that we have, you can get in powder form, but we're using the capsules. No, not the clay. The product that Williams always talks about as and you can get in big bags for animals. No, I'll remember it and I'll let you know and I'll stick it in to the tape at this point as soon as I get back. Let's see, one. If you get on my website and you go into the area that says MP3 lectures and recordings, Epicore, that's what it is, just popped in there. Too many things in this head. E-P-I-C-O-R, Epicore. One capsule, once a day, regardless of body weight. And again, unless your child has a reaction to it, it's one of the least expensive, general, gentle ways to ramp the immune system up and then just keep it at a higher dose. It can be taken daily, long-term. E-P-I-C-O-R. And again, on my website, there's something that either says Epicore or the story of Epicore. It's in the MP3 lectures and recordings. And you got like a 45-minute recording of how Epicore was discovered and what some of the research is. Fascinating.
Jones says the journal that's coming out, we have a very good article on the immune system in which I was were talking to me about it. The only other thing I want to mention, and then I'll open up for a couple of questions, is one of the things that anybody who is sensitive to can be affected by is electromagnetic fields. And the more sensitive somebody is, the more likely they are to be affected by that. And autistic kids are very sensitive. And I have a lot of other people that are not autistic that are very sensitive. And it's really hard to deal with things that you can't see and that you can't really test. There is a technology where there are different types of pendants, for example, that you can wear that have crystals of different types in them that help balance your energies. I've seen them work wonders with some kids. I've seen them not do anything noticeable with other kids. They never hurt anybody. But if you wanted to investigate those, there are only two that I've found very often do help and work. The others, and I've tested many, don't seem to do anything. And those two are, I've got a bioelectric shield on here. It doesn't come with the Jewish star. I put that on with crazy glue. And they don't. You wouldn't probably get the one that's gold. It's too expensive. They have one in silver. But the website is bioelectricshield.com. And there's a crystal matrix inside the shield. And those crystals help support the energy systems of the wearer in ways that we can't even measure. And anything that helps support the energy systems of the wearer makes them less bothered by external energies. So anybody that tells you that that pendant or any other pendant puts this protective field around your body and the other different things can't get in, sorry, doesn't work that way, can't do that, not possible. You'd have to get inside a device called a Faraday cage. But it does help protect in ways that we can't really explain. There's another one called the zero point, which I have underneath here, which I also threw a Jewish star on. and they come in a number of different crystals. This is a hematite. There's a green aventurine, amethyst, and tiger eye. And in my office, if I'm going to use one with a child or an adult, I test to see which one would be most appropriate for that person. But either of these have a bunch of energies in them. And those energies, when you're wearing it or have it in your pocket or whatever, and of course the bioelectric shield is pretty substantial, the others are actual crystals. So if the kid drops it, you just shattered a $160 piece of jewelry, and that gets pretty expensive. But I mean, I've seen absolute differences. I have parents that have said, when he wears that, I see the difference. Depends on the person. I would never say it's true for everybody. But those are two things that help. And the other thing is, anything you can do to lower the amount of electrical fields around your kids, and of course ourselves also, for a larger amount of time is helpful. So I would never want somebody, adult or an autistic child, to sleep with an electric blanket, because that's a horribly large, strong electric field, or on a waterbed with an electric heater, or sleeping with an electric space heater close to you. We want it further away. I wouldn't want a bunch of extension cords underneath the bed. Plug them in somewhere else so they're not running under the bed. Some of the things I've seen that have made differences with kids is that somebody's got a television set and the parents are watching TV, you know, from 9 to 12 o'clock at night, midnight, and the back of the TV set is pointing to the wall behind which is their child. That's where there's no shielding. So you're sending a whole bunch of electrical interference backwards right through the wall, because you can't block that stuff unless you had a lead wall. And so there's a whole bunch of different ways you can do that. And then if you really wanted to try something which costs a little bit more money, which I can pretty much guarantee is going to lower your risk of a lot of different things. I'm not making a penny on it, but I've seen their research, and you can read some of their research. They're made by Stetzer Electric, S-T-E, and I believe it's T-Z-E-R, Stetzer Electric. And they're called, I think he calls them Stetzerizers. You can buy for about $100 or $100 and a quarter one of their meters if you want to. You plug the meter into the wall, and what it measures is the, for lack of a better term, the trash that's on our electric line. If you were to talk to an electrical engineer and you said, if you were to put an oscilloscope on your electric line, what would you see? Would you just see the exact electric line? If they'd done any study of it, they'd say no. You'd see the sine wave of the 60 hertz line with a whole bunch of other stuff on it, because all sorts of trashy stuff gets on there. It even gets put on there when we plug in a computer. If you have a light dimmer, dimmers put a whole bunch of trash on the line. And so they found a way. They were working with the Kazakhstan government for a while. They found a way to pull off and short out the trash without doing anything to the other electric. The problem is that in order to be able to do that, it has to be done in the different rooms, because different rooms have things in them that are producing some of the trash. It doesn't all come in on your power line. So what they say in, and they've done this now in thousands of different houses, what they say on their website, and I've spent an hour with their engineer on the phone, is that most houses take between 15 and 20 of these $35 each units plugged in around the house, and the only way to know exactly how many go in what room is to buy their meter, which you'll last forever, plug it in, and it'll give you a number. I plugged it in my office. It said 1,100. Healthy is below 50. So I plugged a Stetzer unit in. That dropped it down to 280. I plugged another one in. That dropped it down to about 95. So, you know, you can even if you only did it in the room your child slept in, because this only room, if you're going to choose, is there a room that a person spends the largest amount of your time in? It's always the bedroom. So just that one thing might be helpful, so it's worth looking into. And now let me open up for questions. Anything? Yes? Do I do liver support before I do everything else? I do energetic testing. Can be called applied kinesiology, energetic testing, muscle testing, whatever. And so I have to determine, does this child need liver support or kidney support? And if they do, which they often do but not always, then absolutely I would do liver support and or kidney support. If their body tested that they were able to do something else already, even though we haven't done the liver support yet and we could do both together, then we could start on both. If I had to do the liver support first, or the other things that I knew were going to test later aren't testing as being able to be used now, then I would do that first. But yes, I do sometimes do liver and or kidney support on kids. Yes. Which, if you have several kids and some are autistic and some aren't, which ones in the chain are autistic? First, second, third? Okay. So the autistic child is the younger child. Okay. First of all, we have no testing to know all the reasons. In general, if somebody were to ask me, what child would be most likely to become autistic if somebody had, let's say, three kids? My guess, and Autism Research Institute may have this information, so they might disagree with what I'm about to say. My guess would be the second or third, because in general, we have less health in the younger kids. Because when you take somebody who doesn't know anywhere near as much as we should all know about health, the body is amazing. The body has decided that you are less important than your fetus. And so a lot of nutrients get shunted in to give to the fetus, and the mother ends up becoming more deficient. So what then happens is the next child loses out. And so very often, that's the reason that it goes in that direction. But otherwise, we don't always know the reason. That's just one possibility. Yes, ma'am? Do I test heavy metals? Heavy metals are a very fascinating whole realm having to do with testing, which I could talk about for hours. But I rarely test heavy metals. And the reason I rarely test heavy metals is because probably the world expert in heavy metal toxicity and heavy metal removal, which is Dietrich Klinghardt, MD, PhD from Germany, has proven to us absolutely money back that the test gives you no idea of how much heavy metals is in the body. All it does is tell you how much came out that day. And that can be reproven very often. If some doctor doesn't believe this and is listening to this tape, all you would have to do is take four of your patients. You have to invest some money. I do this all the time. I'm amazed at how many health practitioners will not do any of their own little tests. I mean, it takes nothing for me to put in $4,000 or $5,000 to do a little test on five patients just to prove to myself something. And I don't even ask them. my money. I just say, I want you to do this test every month, and I'm going to pay for it. And it's been done. And if you do a test looking at heavy metals, which the best two are either urine or stool, and you do it, let's say, every 6 weeks for, oh, I don't know, let's say you do five of them every 6 weeks. And you've got the patient or the person, whatever, child, on the exact same bonding, chelating, removing agent. It could be ACZ Nano. It could be any of a number of different things. It could be one of the chemicals that I don't like as much. And you watch what happens. And one of the things you're likely to see, which we often see, is a whole bunch of lead comes out. There's no mercury. Huh, what do you know? Okay, the doctor that hasn't taken classes with Dr. Klinghart goes, I guess I was wrong. Must all be lead. No mercury there. Then the next test comes. Lead's quite a bit less. There still isn't any mercury, arsenic, cadmium. Next test comes. Lead's all the way down to zero. Cadmium is almost off the chart, and the mercury's coming up. Because the body has a way that it's going to decide what it's going to release. And so all we ever get to see is what it's decided to release. And we have no idea how that correlates to what's there. So for anybody that's wealthy, I have a few wealthy patients, and I've got a number of doctors that are my patients, and they love to see things. And they go, I want to see the tests. Run the tests. So we run the tests for them. It's their money. I don't mind running the tests. But for people that say, no, I want to help myself or my child get well, and I don't want to pay for any tests that you don't think are necessary, then I'm not going to run a whole bunch of tests. I may run one in a year after a lot of those things are balanced out to see what's still coming out. But otherwise, I run very few for those reasons. Other questions? Yes. That question comes up in every one of my classes. What do you do if you decide you're not going to vaccinate your kids and somebody next door has pertussis or measles or mumps is going through the school? Well, number one, you have to look at what we know. That's the reason that I love Sherry Tenpenny's book and her videos, which maybe we'll carry one of their videos. Because if you actually look and learn a tenth of what I've learned, then what you'll find is vaccinating has never been shown to prevent any of the things that you want to know, what do you do else? So, in other words, you're not making the choice you think you're making. If somebody said, it has been found that on your particular street, that crossing the street between 1125 and 1132 is when the largest number of accidents occur because a couple people are coming home and zipping around and doing something, and so some parent says, what am I supposed to do? That's when my kid has to get across the street. You don't. You go at a different time. We don't have to. So the whole idea is, number one, do the vaccines help reduce the likelihood of each of these diseases? I have seen no properly done research to show that. So therefore, if I don't give a vaccine, I am not reducing the likelihood or increasing the likelihood, or affecting the likelihood. I'm simply saying, I found that this doesn't appear to help, but it can be toxic. Hey, that's a no-brainer. Something that doesn't really seem to help and can be toxic. The people that say it helps are trying to make money. The research doesn't validate it. I simply don't give it. But a better answer would be that those children who get measles and mumps have lifetime immunity. Those people that get a measles or mumps vaccine have no lifetime immunity and are just as likely to get it as an adult when it can cause a problem. So I sincerely hope, and my patients all know this, that every single child that I care for will get any of the childhood diseases that confer lifetime immunity before they're 8 or 10 or 12 years old and get their lifetime immunity. I would like them to. I would like them to have measles parties like they did when I was a kid, where if somebody had measles or mumps or chicken pox, it was up on the wall at the Walden School so everybody could bring their kids over to that person's house and play and get their lifetime immunity and get it over with. This happened all the time. Measles, mumps, and chicken pox. The second answer, or third answer to your question, would be that if your children are the ones who eat less sugar, who eat less flour, that's good for everybody, including adults. That's not just autistic. And if your children are the ones who seem to be about equal otherwise, and they get sick two or three times a year and everything, and you'd like to reduce that risk, then we put them on echinacea, we put them on colostrum, we put them on Epicor, and we make them the ones less likely to get sick. But I'm not looking for another thing to do instead of the vaccine, because from my study, the vaccine simply is not something which is doing what they're claiming and is doing a lot of things I don't like, plus astronomically raising autism, childhood diabetes, and asthma. When I was in school, there were no kids walking around with puffers in their mouth for asthma. That's one of the things that the vaccine seemed to raise. I didn't, because, I mean, this could be a 12-hour seminar. That's true. They don't go over that. And just in the same way that the Autism Research Institute has all those foods in the vendor hall where they've got starches and all the things I don't like, I find that fruit is simply another way to bring sugar into your body. And so if we use a small amount of fruit, it often doesn't cause a problem. It's better as a dessert, because proteins and fats, especially fats, slow down the processing of sugar into the bloodstream. So if you have it as a snack, like a lot of people, you know, tell you to, that's the worst time to have it. And if you have it as a dessert, after having a bunch of fats and protein, that's the best time. And the other thing I tell people about fruit, which I think is one of the most important, is, actually it's two separate things. One is the little berries, other than strawberries, are the highest in nutrients and lowest in sugar. So strawberries have been hybridized to death. You know, organic ones once in a while may be okay, but otherwise, blueberries, raspberries, elderberries, blackberries, you know, loganberries, those are all fine. All the other fruit are higher in sugar than you want. And number two, and very important, body weight. Remember body weight. I have a parent in my office at least three or four times a year, and they come in for their appointment, and I'm sorry I couldn't find a babysitter. You know, you get to meet my daughter. You know, she's whatever, let's say 8 years old. She's, you know, doing fine. And, Mommy, I'm hungry. And she opens the cooler up and she gives her an apple. So we're going over the stuff with the mom or the dad. And the kid's eating an apple. And we're going over a bunch of different other things. And my appointments are not short, so maybe an hour and a quarter later, Mommy, I'm hungry again. Opens up the cooler, peels a banana, hands her a banana. Usually now, within another 5 minutes or so, the kid's hyperactive. And I didn't want to say anything at the beginning, but I have to teach, because that's what it is. You know, it's a Weston Price. What's the most important thing? Teach, teach, teach. And I said, you realize that you just gave your child six full pieces of fruit in a period of an hour. That's not a healthy thing. Mother looks at me like she saw a ghost. I gave her one apple and one banana. Yes, you did. Your child weighs, what, 46 pounds, 48 pounds? Yeah, right about, 40 to 50 pounds. I said, okay, so if an average adult is 150 pounds, and an average adult eats an apple, then if you give a 50-pound person an apple, you just gave her three apples. Because we're not feeding her name. We're feeding her cells. You just gave a third of a person an adult dose of an apple. And then 45 minutes later, you gave her an adult dose of a banana. She got six whole pieces of fruit in an hour. And that's what you're looking at right now, is she's running around hyperactive, where when she came out here, she was nicely coloring. And I always get the same thing. The mother puts her hand on her head and goes, oh my goodness, I never thought about that. That makes perfect sense. Very important, remember the weight of everything. We give an adult a piece of bread. We give a kid a piece of bread. The kid, depending on their weight, just got three pieces of bread. Starch is a problem, and oh my goodness, did you just overload them? Dad gets a muffin. 50-pound kid gets the same muffin. 50-pound kid just got three muffins. So not only do we need to understand how to regulate this, but we need to understand the body weight link for quantities of foods that aren't especially good and how much worse they are then. Yes? Homeopathy. Homeopathy is, there's a book which was actually designed to be both for homeopaths and the public. So it's very comprehensive. And it's called Vaccine-Free Prevention and Treatment of infectious, contagious disease with homeopathy by Kate Birch. Fabulous, fabulous book. But for most people, homeopathy, which is a fascinating science and works very well when it's done correctly, is just too difficult for people to do. However, it does work. It can be used. And there are people, for example, title, The Impossible Cure. It's a book called The Impossible Cure, which is a book by a woman about homeopathy and how it works. And the reason she wrote the book is because her autistic child was 100% cured with homeopathy, and she wanted to tell people what homeopathy was. So it's not something that can be gone over in a short class, because homeopathy, I mean, I went through a 3-year residential program in homeopathy, and I still wouldn't call myself a homeopath. That's how complicated it can be, but it can be very useful. Yep. Mm-hmm. So the question is, you have ant problems in the house, and with an autistic child, you're worried about the chemicals that are going to be used for the ants, which I can understand is a very, very good reason to be very, very worried. There are a lot of different chemicals that are used for that. Most of them I wouldn't use for me. Forget about an autistic child. So it depends on the specific chemicals. The things that can be used for ants that are non-toxic are basically diatomaceous earth, or DE. And you can get on websites, Wisdom of the Ages, permaguard.com, but put in diatomaceous earth or even DE for insects, you know, FOR insects, you'll probably get a whole bunch of websites on that, because diatomaceous earth has been used for insects for a long time. It helps to dehydrate them and break down the cell wall and they die. But it's not an insecticide in that it's not going to kill them and remain killing. Any poison that stays there and keeps working is not good for us. So I would probably avoid that I would avoid it for myself. I mean, I'm going to be treating the house that we just bought, the foreclosure we just bought, I'm going to be treating for termites. And I'm having somebody come down from, I think, Corona, California, I forget where they are, and they use amorphous silica gel, which is those little packets that they put in our cameras and in our supplements to keep them dry. That stuff gets super finely ground into a powder and sprayed all over the attic and every place else, totally non-toxic. Toxicology on the MSDS safety data sheet is zero. And it prevents termites for 5 years or more than that, because if they go through it, it touches them and it dehydrates them and goes away. I don't know how well it would work with other things. But basically, you can call up some of the pest control companies. You can call up Talon. You can call up Corky's. There are a couple out there. And you can say, what non-toxic ant control can you offer me? My family is sensitive to poisons. That's just the easiest way to put it. And we have some ant problems. What can you do? Because I wouldn't do the injections. And you said it. You had a second question?
So my son
had
ear tubes and started.
Okay, so at 4 he had ear tubes, yep. Which should never be done, but doctors do it all the time, yep. I was going to say that doesn't usually, yeah. So basically, when he was 4, he had ear tubes put in to stop the infections, which seemed to work for a while. Infections are back, ear tubes have fallen out. Ear infections are always caused by two things. One, of course, obviously, is the immune system not doing its job well enough. I mean, that's a simple sort of not a fair answer, because what's the reason for that? And so very often when we reduce the sugars, reduce the flour, you know, bring up the good healthy foods, keep the blood sugar level, all of a sudden their immune system works a lot better. And the second has been shown very often, but of course if you tell me that your child doesn't need any of these, then that's not the issue. Very often wheat and dairy, especially dairy, ends up majorly promoting ear infections. There are books written just about that where they cut the dairy out to zero and all the ear infections went away. I never promote ear tubes because there are research studies done on ear tubes and they find overall they don't really work. Okay, so he's on the casein free, gluten free diet. Then my recommendation would be to work on his immune system. If I'm treating an ear infection, then I'm going to use mesosilver, which is a specific type of colloidal silver that's totally non-toxic and that works. What's their website? Purest Colloids, P-U-R-E-S-T-C-O-L-L-O-I-D-S, PurestColloids.com. That's a really, really non-toxic antibacterial, antiviral, antifungal agent. And the only other thing that I can safely use with kids without worrying about it, because it is totally approved even for pregnant women in Germany, is echinacea. And you can get children's echinacea. Again, my favorite is Herbalist and Alchemist, which I said earlier. The local health food stores have a brand called Herb Farm, and Farm is spelled P-H-A-R-M. And they also have a children's echinacea.